Hello and welcome to another episode of Thinking Critically, a D&D discussion, a podcast where we deep dive single word concepts or ideas within the Dungeons & Dragons 5e framework. My name is Danilo, a D&D humanoid, and I like all kinds of games and the crunchy mechanics that make them tick. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, and I'd really appreciate a like or a follow. Today, I'm joined by Ian, aka the Foolish Swami DM. Thank you very, very much for joining. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Ian. I am a dungeon master from Belgium, 25 years old, and I've just started with putting out some stuff on the DMs Guild.
Awesome. We'll look forward to that, hear about that a bit later on. So the topic of today's podcast is structure. So what does that mean to you?
Well, I think structure can be a lot of different things. Depends on what you're talking about. You can have story structure, you can have the way you structurize your games or the way your party is structurized. So I think it depends on what you exactly you're talking about, but it's always about having some kind of balance in your structure. Mm-hmm. It has to be strict enough so it's clear for everybody and that people can hold on to it. Mm-hmm. But there has to be some room for improvisation or going out of that structure just to make the game fun.
Mm. Yeah, you've pretty much hit on almost all of my notes there. But one good thing that I heard there is that the rules are of 5e, D&D 5e are a framework, right? They are guidance, but the very nature of the game is improvisational, as you said. So I think getting that balance right, not only in moment-to-moment play, but also in writing homebrew, like you just said, for something for the DM's Guild, for something, is very difficult to do. And I am halfway, which is putting it kindly, through a published module or a module I intend to get published, which is one I've run before, completely homebrew, but really trying to strike the balance there between, okay, this DC needs to be this, and then the NPC says that, and this is bang, 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 this is a sequence of events that happens, versus how I usually run their game, which is the complete opposite of, you know, sitting on the edge of my seat and just firing from the hip kind of thing. So I think the structure of 5e and as a gameplay experience is difficult to get right, basically, from every different point of view.
I've never played any other system of D&D except for 5e. Mm-hmm. So I can't compare it to 3.5 or 4, for example. I think the structure is set and people tend to get lost in it. Mm. But the moment you start writing, because you were saying you wrote something for DM's Guild, the moment you start writing stuff for other people, it takes on a new level. Mm. And you have to think about, why am I going to structuralize it in this way? A lot of the stuff you can find on DM's Guild, especially the one-shots, they are very straightforward, kind of railroady, structuralized. Mm. And that's something I personally don't like. Mm-hmm. Not because it's not a good way to write a story, but what happens when my players don't reach the clue that they need to get at point A to go to point B? Mm-hmm. And then you can be kind of fucked in your game. And then you have to pull off some kind of Deus Ex Machina that they're not going to like, because then they feel like you're treating them as a bunch of little kids. Yep. So when I sit down to write the adventures I write, I always go for sandbox. Mm-hmm. I create the setting, I create the NPCs, I create the plotline and how all of this fits together. But it's on you, the GM, to actually run it. So I give you the structure for you to work in. And that's the way I try to empower other DMs who might not have the time to do the writing that I can do. Mm-hmm. Or just maybe don't want to be bothered with it because they're like, this is my free time. I don't want to spend all this extra stuff into it. I don't want to get out of my comfort zone to write a whole bunch of plot lines. Just give me something that works and I'll run it.
Yeah, people DM for different reasons. And I think you and I are quite alike. And I do it because I like that world building aspect, that, well, this will be cool if this thing happens. And oh, wouldn't it be good if there was this other thing down the line? Whereas some DMs, and it's totally fine, are DMing for the activity at the table. And as long as they have a toolkit ready to use, then they're hot to trot and good to go. So it's kind of a I scratch your back, you scratch mine, in a way, which is quite nice. You touched on there about kind of one shots on DM's Guild, or just in general the structure of a one shot, and one of my notes was going to talk about how do we tell a compelling story in one to maybe three sessions? I think, as you said, it's kind of difficult to do.
Yeah, I think, especially when you're going about writing very short stories, the structure of your story has to empower the game master who's going to run it. So to me, that means giving them a lot of freedom in a framework in which they can decide how they want to run it. So when you start writing a story, you should think about three main things. One, the setting. Two, what is now occurring in the setting? What is happening? How is this setting going to influence my players? Mm-hmm. And then three, what are the other people in this setting that are influencing this story? So you have your setting, your plot line, and your NPCs. Mm. And if you can work those two together and kind of entail them in a spider web, you can create some kind of sandboxy feel, even in a 4-hour session, where wherever they kind of go, they can always find a clue that goes back to the center.
Mm.
And that way you can create a compelling story without having to kind of push them forward. It can be all about the players and which way they want to go.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really elegant way of putting it. And I have to agree that in the few number of one-shots I've read and seen, they are very like a Saturday morning cartoon. It's bang, bang, bang. It's here's a setup, here's the middle bit, and here's the end. And to me, that feels very prescriptive, very blinkered, because you're basically saying, for the sake of achieving a session in one game, we're kind of having to cut out half of what makes D&D D&D, which is a shame, in my opinion. But I guess people don't have a desire to only play long-form campaigns. Your metaphor there of kind of the spider web, I think, is a great... I've never really thought about design, you know, the structure of a story in that way before. I've come at it from more a flow, a process perspective. So I really want to try and think about how I can employ that in my game, but it ties in nicely with something I've read in the past where it's the rule of threes. So to use your example of clues or hooks for players, I've always read there should be at least three, and all three lead to the same thing, but you need at least three because the players are going to miss them.
Yeah, it's a combination of the rule of three and the 5-room dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two of the bigger texts right now out there when you talk about story structure. And 5-room dungeon says there's 5 rooms. Each room has a certain thing to it,
mm-hmm.
a certain feel. And those rooms together make a nice dungeon, make a nice story structure, which you can refer back to the Act of Five because it kind of fits together as well. And then you have the rule of three, that you always need 3 clues mm-hmm. that go back to another thing. But those 3 clues don't all three have to go back to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can say my story has a 5-room dungeon, but a 5-room dungeon doesn't have to be linear. It can be set in a circle. And in each of these rooms, they can find 3 clues. And each of these clues will go back to another room. And that way you create a web.
Mm.
If you now end those rooms with those clues, you put together NPCs who give the clues, or the clues are about NPCs or about NPC interactions, then you're creating a big web.
Mm.
But it's all about the same story. So you can actually run it in maybe sometimes 4 hours, sometimes 12 hours, depending on the pace your players are setting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still that same story.
Mm.
It's just woven together.
Mm. It's nice. The metaphor of a spider's web has now become a literal web of rooms in a dungeon, which is quite good. The only problem that I see there, and it's a problem I faced myself many times, is obviously when it has to remain sensible or congruous. So if the dungeon is literally a cave system underground, or maybe some typical lich's lair, then you can have that labyrinthine network of rooms. But say the dungeon is something unusual, like a abandoned hospital, for example, then the internal logic of what a hospital is kind of has to come first, if you know what I mean. There has to be wards and corridors and pediatrics and stuff like that, versus I think what's nice is that there's a balance, which is what we started this discussion of, is how far you move that slider from internal realism towards this network design is where the expertise comes from, really, and good dungeon design ultimately lies within.
Yeah, but it's not because it's... Let's look at your example of the hospital. I think it's a very interesting example. You can still have the 5 rooms. The 5 rooms, it's from John Fall, actually. Great guy.
Mm-hmm.
Has a lot of interesting stuff. So the 5 rooms, the first room is entrance and guardian. The second room is puzzle or role-playing challenge. The third room is trick or setback. The fourth is the climax, the big battle or the conflict. And the fifth is reward, revelation or plot twist.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because you're in a hospital that you can't have these five rooms or these three clues per room. Mm-hmm. Because the room and the clues are about the story, not about the place. The setting mm-hmm. is just the sandbox you create, which shows your players you can do whatever you want, but within this setting.
Mm.
So, because we're talking about structure, it's a structure you make to show them, like, you can be free in whatever you do, but if you go outside of this box, then we're out of the story.
Mm.
And that can be a hospital, it can be a dungeon, it can be a village, it can be a world,
mm.
depending
mm.
on how big you want a story to make.
Mm.
And each room, even if it has to be set in some kind of reality, like it has to be pediatric ward or some other typical place in a hospital, they can still talk about that story. You can put clues in your pediatric ward with NPCs, with stuff they find about the overall arc of the story. It just depends on what story it is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go about it in a creative way, you can actually do it. It's doable,
mm-hmm.
but you have to want to. And if you don't want to, that's okay, because it's just not the way you structure your games.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I think I am, and this is a personality trait of mine, interpreting it very literally, and I need to kind of take a step back, and then using the word room as a tool to articulate something rather than literally meaning four walls and a ceiling.
Yeah, the five rooms are about some kind of emotion or something that happens in the room. Like, room one is an entrance, but an entrance can be trapped, it can be hidden, it can require a special key, it can just be coming into a story. Your entrance can be just your first arc in your story, where people come into a town and they get to know all the NPCs. That's your entry. They've known about the city and you have your setup. And then room two can be your puzzle or your role-playing challenge. It can be something that happens. It can be something that shows the players, like, there's something more here. A puzzle doesn't have to be literally a puzzle. It can be something that's puzzling.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your trick or your setback. Suddenly something happens. They get captured, or some NPC they just liked died, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it can show that there's, okay, now you're sure there's something more around here. And then mm-hmm. they have to work for room four. They go around finding clues. They might find rewards in those clues. They might find plot twists, which are room five.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some revelations. And all these little pieces together will lead to room four, the climax, the big battle, or the conflict.
Mm-hmm. The reason I use that hospital example is because that's actually one I've designed unbeknowingly with almost the five-rule dungeon in mind. I think I am lucky in that it kind of came naturally to me in my desire to make a very interesting dungeon. A lot of those things kind of fell into place. Now, I could have formalized it a little bit better with, like, a breadcrumb trail of the clues throughout. But the setback, for example, there was a central circular staircase in this hospital. And in typical fantasy fashion, there was a trap there where the stairs disappeared and the characters would slide down to the bottom. You know, classic Scooby-Doo trap. And the setback there is, you know, they've come in on the ground floor. They investigate the ground floor. Okay, let's head up into the first floor. Oh, hit this trap. And then they slide all the way back down to, like, the basement level, where there's another room, essentially, which, again, has these little... had an NPC in there, potentially friendly, potentially an enemy. And that, I must admit, worked out very well. And for a period of time, the players were like, well, do we need to go up or do we need to go down? It was that middle puzzling bit that you mentioned. So, yeah, you've convinced me that, even though I use that example as, say, one that might not work in, little did I know that I'd actually made it work in myself almost without even knowing it. So that's something I want to do some homework on and have a think about how I can do that. At the moment, I'm running a current dungeon for my players right now, which is your typical kobold cave system. And I kind of brute forced the freedom by literally having the first kind of outside of the entrance room. The next room they come into is just a split, just three tunnels. And it's there you go, guys. You've got three ways to go around this dungeon, and it's circular in nature. And there could have been perhaps some more guidance there, you know, scratch marks to suggest one tunnel was used for a particular reason, or humidity in another tunnel to suggest that led to an area of water might have been a better thing to do. But that's the kind of stuff that I need to work on. And when I get round to, if I ever get round to writing this down for DM's Guild. Those are the kind of things I have to remind myself to include.
Yeah, but that's a structure you put down for your players, because mm-hmm. it gives them an idea of what to choose between. You're telling them you have 3 tunnels, mm-hmm. but right now they have no clues, no foreshadowing what they could expect in those tunnels. Mm-hmm. And if that's something you usually do with your players, it's okay. They won't really react badly to it because they're used to it. It's the structure that mm-hmm. they have that you've always given them as a DM. But some players will always look for a way to find that structure. You're going to have those players who will try to do like 3 investigation checks mm-hmm. just to be sure about something. Mm-hmm. And that's because they need that structure. There's an caregiving. There's a theory, a system, where they talk about structure versus care.
Okay.
What it basically says is that a child needs both to grow. And it's the same with your players as a mm-hmm. dungeon master. It's the same when you're running a company. It's the same when you're talking to other people. You need to give them a structure that they know and that they can trust. And then you give them care within that structure. For example, it's okay if you don't know what that spell does. We'll take a look together. We'll figure mm-hmm. it out. But the structure is, oh, you need 1 spell slot of 6th level to cast that spell. So they know, I can only try this if I have this. And then next to that, if I'm afraid of something or I don't know what's happening, they're going to help me. Mm-hmm. Because if your players lose that trust, and that can be because you're not caring for them or you're not giving them enough structure, mm-hmm. then you're going to see a lot of against play, a lot of anti-play. Mm-hmm. Where players like, oh yeah, you come into town and you have to give up all your weapons. Nope, I'm not doing that. Nope, I'm not giving away my weapons. You're gonna kill me.
Yeah, I think they're not quite there yet. They can be quite antagonistic, but I don't think that is purely due to a lack of foreshadowing on my part. I think a lot of them are first-timers and they're doing a little bit of wish fulfillment in terms of, I just want to be the bad boy and be an antagonist, essentially. I could definitely, and I'm kicking myself now because I really like the idea that I made up on the spot of each one of those tunnels being foreshadowed in some unique way. So now I'm annoyed that I didn't do that when I actually ran the bloody thing. So lesson learned, I suppose. So yeah, there's probably improvements again there that I can do. And, you know, the purpose of this podcast is to kind of have these little nuggets of tips and things to think about. And so I'm really happy that we're discussing this real nitty-gritty, you know, structure of writing something. And as I mentioned previously, for me, it's I'm just winging it.
Yeah, but don't forget that you need to take care of yourself as well. It's not mm-hmm. because you forget something that is bad. It's okay. Mm. Did your players enjoy themselves? That's all I care about.
they're halfway through it at the moment. We're just about to take a break for Christmas period, but well, we'll see if they get out the other side first, and then I'll tell you whether they enjoyed it or not.
I design my structure in a way that I can take care of my story, myself, and my players, mm-hmm. so that we can all have fun, and that there's mm-hmm. enough space to do some stupid stuff. For example, my players went to a bar. They did a huge challenge there that the barkeep was 100% sure they could never do it, so he betted a lot of money against them. Mm-hmm. In the end, of course, they did it. And the barkeep was so broke that he had to sell his bar. And mm-hmm. the players, of course, with all the money, bought the bar and gave it their own name.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So it's about making a structure that allows for those moments. It's about a structure that allows for doing something bad, getting a call wrong. Mm-hmm. Because if you create that kind of sense with your players where you can talk about it, then you can say, look, last session I did something wrong. Do you want to retake it? Do we go further with the story like it's now? Mm-hmm. And they'll tell what they want. Mm-hmm. But it's that structure that makes sure that your players keep coming, and that makes sure that there's an understanding between the different players or with you and a player. Mm-hmm. It's that structure that makes sure that players will trust you in what you're doing, and they know mm-hmm. that you're not going to just kill them out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Or that you're not going to do this like big world-changing event without their characters being in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think I've done a fairly decent job of communicating that and building that trust, I like to think. Well, they're still quite dubious of, you know, a lot of NPCs, which I don't know where that's come from, because I've met a heck of a load of really friendly NPCs, but that's a story for another time. But yeah, in terms of not just unfairly killing them, that I'm very paranoid of that kind of stuff. So yeah, I go to great lengths to ensure that there's no just one roll, deaths. Fail to save, okay, that's 10d10 damage. Whoops, you're dead. Okay, that just kind of sucks for everybody. And is crap storytelling as well. Unless, of course, you know, the usual caveats of have you foreshadowed it? You know, has there been obvious signs that if they do that, they will get hurt? And then, okay, yeah, the gloves are off and they're going to get got. So we talked earlier on about your thoughts on how to tell a compelling story in 1 to 3 sessions with that 5-room web-based theory crafting. Is that the same for a long-form campaign?
It can be. I know I certainly like to work in that way where I have a world and a lot of things are happening in this world and it's because of this, this, and this, and this.
Mm-hmm.
And in this place, you're going to notice that this way. And in this place, you're going to notice that this way. And in this place, you're going to notice that this way. And if you connect all those little dots together, you're going to know where to go next.
Mm.
And your players are going to drive the story forward because they want to know, okay, but like we had some demon sightings in this city and we had some celestial sightings in this city. Is there like a connection between these two? What could this mean? Maybe we should go to some kind of temple, figure out if there's something happening there.
Mm.
So it's a web you also create, but you just make it a little bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I make very story-heavy campaigns, and that's not everyone's take, and mm-hmm. that's okay. But for me, I almost never run like random encounters.
Yeah.
I can make a random encounter table, and I'll run the table, but it will be encounters I've designed to let the players know something more about my world, or about the story,
yeah,
or about what's actually happening in this place.
Yeah, they make sense in universe.
Yeah, for me it's all about story, and it doesn't mean that the world can be random. It can, but it will be in a way that makes sense, or in a way that players will think like, oh yeah, you know, 5 sessions ago we saw that little dwarf guy who was talking about this kind of dwarf lord, and now we meet that dwarf lord who has something to do with the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am completely the same. I am rubbed up against that need for constant encounters while they travel, or you know, 7 encounters a day or whatever the number is, and every time I've gone, nah, I'm just not gonna, because it doesn't make sense. And one of my players at one point said, hey, really loving the campaign and whatnot, but it feels like we haven't had combat in forever. And I said, oh, let me have a think, because that's not been my perception. And I said, well, actually, to be fair, you guys are in a major city. You did an encounter there that you did without combat. So, I mean, you chose not to have combat in that instance. And then you've gone from one city to another on a very safe travel route. And no one wants to kill you there. So, you know, there's not going to be any combat because you're in the middle of a popular city. And at the moment, they're at a low enough level where they're not, you know, targeted by assassins or other arbitrary fights. But on the second hand, they're also not low enough level that the combat would have to be quite exotic. And to have basilisks burrow up out of the ground might make sense if that fits what's happening in your campaign with subterranean creatures coming up. But otherwise, it's going to be very random for the capital city to be like, whoa, this is the first basilisk attack we've had in 400 years. And it just so happens that it happens to be when the players are there. So yeah, I'm a huge proponent of making the combat encounters make sense in universe.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that you can't have like random combats. It doesn't mean you can't just have a good combat, but there's always going to be a second layer to it.
Mm-hmm.
It can also just be so that you're doing the combat just to meta-wise teach your players something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry to jump in, but it's great minds again, because it, literally in the early levels, after a piece of combat, I explicitly said to them, okay, that's to teach you that enemies have resistances. Like, now you'll know not to blow all your spell slots, because this is the first time you've had 3 in combat encounters in a row. That kind of stuff, you know, especially for the newer players, I explicitly said, okay, this combat has taught you that if one of you gets stunned, that's bad. Or damage resistances are a thing, and that's bad.
I think, especially at the younger levels, random combats can add a lot to the story, even if you don't put as much in it as a DM, just like a combat with random bandits at that point can learn the party how they should structuralize themselves in a combat situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who's going to be in the front? Who's going to be in the back? Who has the flanks? Who has the range? Who needs to be everywhere for the healing? And by letting them try out those little things with these little kind of combats, they're going to figure it out before they hit their first major villain.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to die like a bunch of snowflakes in the sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're preparing them. As you said, it's that care factor.
Yeah.
Of guiding them to be like, this is the stuff that can happen. And also from a mechanical point of view to that bandit encounter, it can also swing the other way in terms of if they could talk their way out of it or whatever. There's another route that they could potentially take. And that again teaches them, hey, you don't have to murder everything you come across.
Yeah, it gives them an opportunity to figure mm-hmm. out the party structure. Are we a party who talks first, or are we a mm-hmm. party who hits first?
Mm-hmm.
Are we a party who flanks? Are we a party who just goes straight forward? Are we a party of spellcasters who just, hey, let's just keep our distance and let's just fuck them all up with fireball?
Mm-hmm. Which, that latter one tends to be how my guys go. I'm kind of running two games at the moment and both have the cliche of a very fireball happy caster on the back line. So yeah, check that D&D bingo box. But also that it's a really elegant way of, as you mentioned, of having flavor put into the world. So perhaps these bandits are quite well maintained. Maybe they've got decent armor on them. But hang on, why are they highwaymen? Why are they holding up people on the side of the road? That begs the question then of what the heck is happening in the economy in this part of the city? And that's such a elegant way of introducing those moments of flavour that you don't have to heavy hand later on with, oh, the politicians have said that bandits are now rich and have got loads of money and can afford really good stuff on a newspaper they see next time they go to town.
Yeah, for example, or maybe your bandits are starving and that's why they're attacking, because mm-hmm. they're not able to get any food because of XYZ that then later on has a more significant part of your story. It doesn't have to be, oh, this encounter has thing A that directly connects to B. No, it can go a few extra steps.
Mm-hmm.
Your world and what the story that is happening in the world is going to influence your world and everyone in it, not only the party.
Mm-hmm.
So it's before you do a random encounter, you can use a random encounter table, but just think about how can I put something in here that shows the way my world is structuralized and that shows what is happening. Maybe on a very small scale. Not everything has to be grand.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's something I need to think about. I'm quite happy with how it's gone so far. Hands up, they have had one generic bandit encounter, which at the time was pretty straightforward, pretty much on the face of it. They got attacked in the night by the side of the road by bandits. Okay. However, the beauty of D&D is that I then have complete freedom to incorporate that, not in point B maybe, but in point C, D, E, and F later on, to say, hey, those guys that attacked you on the road, well, maybe they were in some way related to something else, or because you killed them all and murdered them all and got rid of the bodies without checking the bodies, you didn't know that they were hired by somebody, and so on and so on. So I'm quite I guess a fan of DM retconning when it is fair to do so. I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, because that's the structure of your game and your world.
Mm-hmm.
Other people might think, I just put out a bunch of orc attacks because that's my world. Orcs are aggressive and they go around, and that's the structure. If you're going to travel a road, you know it's going to be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So by showing your players that, showing, not telling, by showing them that, you teach them how to interact with your world.
Mm.
And there again, you have that structure versus care thing. Because you're caring for them, you're heeding them for what's going to happen in this world, how it works. But you're giving them the structure of how to fit into it. And then they're going to do the same thing for you, because they're going to show you, this is my character. Please care for my character.
Mm.
This is what he likes, this is what he doesn't like, this is how he roleplays.
Mm.
And you can show that care in different ways. For some DMs, it's making special patrons for warlocks. For mm-hmm. others, it's making specific magic items for certain players because they know that is their playstyle and they're going to use it in that way. Mm-hmm. And it's all about the balance between those things. And the balance is always according to the one who is running the game with the people he's running it for.
Mm.
There's no structure that always works.
No.
Some people just want to hit some monsters,
mm-hmm.
and that's okay. And other people want more roleplay, and that's okay. And some tables will have a mix.
Mm-hmm. Which is where I find myself with quite a varied player base of six who do run that whole gamut from I want to hit something to, here's my warlock patron, please let's have interactions with them, Mr. DM. Which is fun and interesting and sometimes hard to get them all to come together and work together to do a single cause. But it ties in very nicely with, on the previous episode of this podcast, I was talking to Manny about emotions and trying to find out what makes players tick and trying to elicit a response from them. Ties in very nicely to how you structure your world to enable that.
I'm running Storm King's Thunder at the moment, and I've made an expansion. I'm calling it the Kraken Society expansion, and I'm going to write it and put it on DM's Guild later, but it's going to take some time. I have 8 players around my table.
Wow.
Which is
okay.
A lot.
Yeah, I'll shut up talking about how problem it is with my 6 players. Cause,
I have 8 players. They're all very different in the way they want to play. I have players who need to get out 54 dick jokes in one session or they're going to explode. I have players who need to have the feeling of deep emotion in a session. And I have players who just want to slice someone's head off. Mm-hmm. And I have players who are in between all those three. And that's okay. And I've always said to them from the beginning, I said, I'm going to run a campaign. And the reason why I started running D&D in my hometown was because I moved from university and I got back after a few years and not really talking with anyone. And I was like, I don't really have any friends here. But of course, I had friends, I had acquaintances from before, I have family here. I just wanted a way to be able to have fun with my friends at least once in a month. And for me, that was D&D, because it also allowed me to do some storytelling. And I said from the beginning of this campaign, I said, I'm going to run it. We can be with 8 players, but everybody needs to be able to participate in it in the way they want to. Which means that for the guy who just wanted to do dick jokes, he can. But not always in the forefront, you know, sit next to a guy who really loves your dick jokes and just now and then talk between the two of you. It's okay. While maybe I'm doing the intricate roleplay with the one who needs the deep emotions. But it also means that some players will not experience the game in the same way. And that is something that players need to know, that if they're not going to do a lot of note keeping, if they're not going to take a lot of attention and it's just going to be running forward and hitting things, that they're going to miss a deeper layer in my games, because that's the way I create my games.
Yeah.
And if they're okay with that, then that's okay for me. And that is the structure we have laid out between us. And it's because I have these kind of structures with my players, with all 8 of them, that I'm able to run for 8 players, because they know when to shut up, because I've told them. I've told him before when I was doing a one-on-one kind of roleplay thing with one, and the guy with his dick joke just said one too loud at the wrong time, and I just turned my head and I said, dude, shut up. You're taking this moment away from him.
Yeah.
So structure is not only about how you do the rules, how you play with the rules, how you play with each other, but also sometimes being like tough love. Sometimes being a tough parent saying, no, this is the line, I'm sorry. But this is not going to work if we're going to do all of this together.
I think there won't be a table that hasn't required an interaction like that. In the past, I've had to say, all right, guys, shut up, because I can't hear the conversation I'm trying to have. And I've said, like, you go and laugh, but this guy's trying to have, he doesn't roleplay that often. So I'm really having to, this is a great opportunity here and you guys are talking over it. So shut up and listen, basically. They've had their goofy time. So now it's serious time. So yeah, there won't be a game where that hasn't happened or someone's lying if they say, because that's just human nature.
I always tell my players, especially at the beginning of sessions, I'll often start my session with, guys, can you all listen to me? My ego needs your attention now. And just by putting in those small kind of jokes, they know like, okay, this is where we draw the line, but I'm not attacking them. So there's different ways to put in the structure. As you have with story, there's different way to put in a story that you have. You can go straightforward, railroad. You can go the spider web we talked about. But it's the same with structuring the way you talk to people. It's not because I'm not okay with the behavior you're setting that I have to put that in a negative sense. I can tell you with a warm and calm voice, like, okay, I understand you find this funny, but right now, at this moment, it just doesn't work for me. And maybe 5 minutes later, if he would say the same joke, I would maybe be cracked up.
Yeah, that's just being a human being. And the only frustrating thing is that everything we're talking about is much easier said than done, even in a laboratory setting, let alone a live table, when especially the DM has a million and one things going around in their head. But I think that's where you start to see that separation from, I don't want to say amateur, that sounds too harsh, but you know what I mean, just someone who's picked up the Dungeon Master's Guide and gone, let me give this a shot, to somebody who's putting in a shitload of effort to really have an experience.
Well, the biggest difference is the kind of game master who can actually pull it off, having a lot of players, having a lot of story, having a lot of everything, is the one who knows his structure and the structure of his players. He has set a way of sitting around the table with all of them together that works for him, that allows him to maintain the story as well as maintain the fun, and to max out both of them and to play it with him. He's a director of an orchestra, and the orchestra is played by the players, and the instruments are the story. And he knows exactly when to maybe put in a little bit more bass, or when to go for the hi-hats, or when to go for the strikers. It's because he has set up the structure himself. He has created it.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of thinking about it, really. And it also kind of reinforces that idea of we're all in it together, right? Everyone has a part to play, and, you know, we all have times where we need to clang that triangle. And if we don't, then it might fall a bit flat.
For me, the ideal session is the session where I don't have to do a lot.
Oh, for sure.
And the only way to create that is if you set expectations between players and between yourself with your players. And by doing that, by giving that a certain structure, they know how to communicate with each other. I can give you a more concrete example. With Corona hitting the world and we went in Belgium in lockdown the first time, I had to run suddenly an internet game on Roll20 with 8 players. I had no idea how to do that. So we did a one-shot, Honey Heist von Grand Howard. Went terribly. I finished it. I was exhausted. I hated it. But my players enjoyed it. And it was just an overload because I didn't know how to structuralize my games through the internet.
Yeah,
I never done it before. And so one of the things I talked about with players is there's a lot of time between your takes where you don't have a lot of input as a player when you play online.
Yeah.
You just sit in front of a screen. You have to wait, especially if you're running a combat with 8 players. You just have to wait, and there's not much to be done. So one of the things I did with my players, we created a Discord server with different text channels and different video channels where players could switch between the channels if they wanted to maybe just talk about tactics during the combat, and they would just switch. And when it was their turn, I could just pull them back into the server where I was running the combat, and they knew what to do.
That's a
and
good
in
idea.
The meantime, we did different text channels because some of them really wanted to still make dick jokes. So we had a meme channel. And during the game, I only saw it afterwards, but 50, 100 memes during a 4-hour session would be on there. And I would have a great time afterwards reading them.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, my players were still listening to what was happening, but they found an outlet for that creativity that they normally can do at the table that they couldn't do online.
Yeah, I think that shift to online play has obviously hit everybody, or pretty much everybody, myself included. I was lucky in that I'd had some mainly player experience of remote play. And what's interesting is obviously there's a bit of a anxiety there. As you said, like, I've not done this before. It's a completely different way of, not completely different way of playing, but a bit of a different way of playing, right? It's a different atmosphere. It's a different vibe. And aside from your idea there of having a different voice channel and text channel, which is something I'm absolutely going to steal, my players have kind of taken to it quite well. And yes, there's only 6 in quotes, but they have taken to it rather well. And in some ways, it's got them to focus more despite being distanced, because there's no table play, which some have admitted, like, they enjoyed that, but it actually took them out of the game. So they were kind of sacrificing the game to have something else. But now one of them said, you know, that's actually, I didn't know, but I actually did want to focus and think more. And now I can, because I'm not dicking around with my mate next to me. So the structure there has changed to enable the new ways of approaching it and new ways of thinking about it. And I think for the better, it's we're lucky, I think, in that we've transitioned quite well to a digital format. An analogy I used earlier on, I was thinking about when I was writing my notes for this thing about long form story structure, is the way I do it, at least, which I think we've discussed, is not prescriptive. It's similar to you in that it's very free form. It's very, here are your major pieces, here are your major players. The players can fill in the gaps and tie it all together themselves. And what I likened it to is there's a film, a Wallace and Gromit film, which those in the UK will be familiar with, where he's on a model train going around the lounge and he's putting the track down in front of him as he's going around the train. And that was what I likened my DM style to, in that the lounge might have a coffee table in it and a footstool and a couple of chairs, which would be your big bad encounters, your dungeons. But the way the players lay the track to get there is entirely up to them, in a way. So they're kind of laying their own. I mean, now I think about it, it's actually a bad metaphor because of the railroading suggestions to it. But I quite like that idea of, you know, they could go left, they can go right, they can do a loop and whatnot. But those big things are still present in the universe. And if someone comes in and, you know, tucks the chair in, which is ties into what we were saying earlier on, like other actors in the setting can impact it. That can still happen while the players are having fun putting the track down in front of themselves. So that was my own way of badly describing the chaotic nature of my of my campaign structure.
I think it's a fun analogy. The dog, is he Wallace or Gromit?
He is Gromit.
Okay, so if you look at Gromit as your players, then you're not railroading because they're deciding which track to take. You've put down a world, a setting, a sandbox with chairs and tables, and they decide if they want to go to the chairs first or to the tables first. Or
Yeah, precisely. And the way I've done that, and this isn't blowing my own trumpet, this is just, you know, food for thought for listeners or yourself to say, okay, that's it. That's one way to do it, is I riffed on the small amount of Critical Role one I'd listened to. So I have in the macro completely sandbox, in that here's eight things you can go after, players pick any one of the eight, you know, chapters in the book. If they want to do chapter 7 and then chapter 3, cool, that's fine. So that's a very high level structure, kind of freeform structure I've put in place to say you can go left and then you can go right, or you can go straight and then you can go right. What I probably need to apply a little more structure to is the moment to moment, the five room dungeons, the scratch marks on the tunnel wall, that kind of stuff is what I personally need to work more on. And I think once I have that in place, the whole thing will be uplifted.
The moment you will have put kind of the structure of a five room dungeon in your game, or the moment you've internalized that into your the way you think about your campaign, the foreshadowing stuff, it will just be there. It'll just happen. Your players will go to a place and you know they're going to hit A first and then they're going to go B. But you know in B this and this happens, and you know they have to be prepared. So you'll just make up something in A to foreshadow it, which can be very easy. Maybe an old friend who just recently visited point B and can talk about what's happening there. Or it can just be some kind of material clue, or it can just be gossip. The reason why it's fun to have a world that lives and breathes is because you can use that world to foreshadow for your players.
And it's something I'm definitely going to employ in the chapters that they haven't gone to yet, of which there's plenty left, and try and incorporate those elements a little bit more, just to do a little bit more signposting, despite having DM'd for quite a long time, you know, a good couple of years, and this, you know, with these players, I still struggle with that player DM perception. So obviously it's very difficult to disassociate yourself from the structure that you've built and the structure that you've planned, and to try and flip that around and see, yeah, but the players can only see this tiny slither of it, and they're making their decisions based on, you know, 2 degree slither of the pie of the structure, whereas I can see 360 degrees.
Yeah, but you can always talk about it with your players. If something happens, if you see that they're approaching something very slowly or in a way that you didn't expect, you can just ask, why did you do it that way? And what do you need to do it in a way that I felt like it should have been done? And not by going A or B. It's not like the way I think is the right way.
Yeah, Yeah, I understand.
But I'm talking more about the behavior your players will put forward. If your players are, as players, afraid, you'll notice it in your game. And you can just ask them, why were you so afraid of going to this point? What was holding you back? And what do you need to actually be able to go there confidently without being afraid that something very big is going to happen? I say this because I have very big, very deadly encounters in my game. And sometimes they come out of nowhere where I might have felt like I foreshadowed this. Or it's normal if you're going to act this, this, and this way against this, this, and this kind of monster, he's going to try to rip your head off.
Yeah.
But my players didn't know. I didn't foreshadow it to them enough. And so that's my fault. And I've told them, like, okay, I don't want to do you guys like this. You're my friends. So what do you need from me in order to not make this happen anymore? And some of them told me what it is that they specifically needed. And others said, it's fine for me the way it is. But it's not because you're the one making the structure that you're the only one who has input in that structure. Your players, as well as creating the game, as well as creating the story, they also create that structure by saying to the other guy who's 5 minutes late, bro, you're late, come on. Or when it's taking you like a half a century to pick a date, them just saying, can you just please fill in the doodle or something so we can, you know, have a game?
Yeah.
It's a responsibility that you hold up together. You're not the only one carrying this game as a game master. It has to be the whole table.
Yeah, that's really wise words. And hands up, I've been getting a little bit burned out, if I'm being honest, over the past couple of weeks and months. And that's partly due to just the onslaught of D&D that my life now is, but also partly because of feeling like I was having to do a lot of the heavy lifting. And it wasn't so much of the DM sets the pieces up and the players knock them down. It was pretty much I was having to do a lot of the knocking down as well. So coming into the December, I said, okay, look, guys, we're going to take a break over Christmas and New Year's. I need to recharge, refresh, you know, approach the story from a different perspective. Going into next year, here's how things are going to change. And I set that expectation perhaps a bit too late or perhaps at the best time. That remains to be seen. But I basically said, you've got to learn the rules because we're 50 sessions in. So you've got to learn the rules. You've got to learn your spells. If you don't, you'll lose your turn or you'll take the dodge action. If you continue to do so, then either you leave or I leave, essentially. That's not where we're at yet, but it's getting there, right? And it ties back into what you said before, like the DM is, unless you're being paid to do it, you're there to make, to have fun yourself, and you've got to really take care of that.
Don't forget both sides of the coin, because you're telling them, this is my structure, you need to learn the rules, and if you don't, then it's over. But have you asked them, what do you need from me to learn those rules? Is there something I can do to help you? You have to take care of them as well. It goes both ways.
Not in those exact words. Obviously, I've offered them my rulebook many times in the past and have told them how to get the rules and stuff. But
it doesn't have to be in that kind of way. I'll give an example of myself and an example of a player. I'll start with myself. Recently, we use Doodle to set up when we're going to play. And often it takes a lot of time and I have to ask again and again and again for some people to just fill it in. And what that had done to me as a person is that I felt like my players didn't want to play my game because they weren't filling in the date. And I've now recently said, look, I'm not going to make another doodle again. If you want to play, then make a doodle. And what that I've seen now is players just saying, are we going to play again? Where's the doodle? And so I know that they want to play again. And I know that I'm not constantly in my head thinking, oh, they don't want to play. They don't want to play. So that way I've told them, this is my structure. Can you take care of me? And they did. But it goes the other way around. There's another side of the coin. I had a player who had a very interesting but very complex character, especially in combat. And for him, taking a turn was taking forever. ever. He was thinking about maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that. And I asked to him, like, why is it taking you so long? And he told me, like, I have to go to all these pages and I have like these bonus actions, but then I also have the actions and then I have spells and I don't know which one to use when. And if I use this one, can I use that one or not?
Mm-hmm.
And what we created together is we made some kind of mind map of all the actions he can take in combat.
Mm-hmm.
We've put them under action, bonus action, spells. So he just has to look, okay, for action, I can do these things. For bonus action, I can do these things. For reaction, I can do these things. And so he just has to decide, and we color coded him, which mm-hmm. what is defense, what is offense, what is buffing. So he can kind of have an idea like, okay, I need an action, I want to attack, I want to deal damage. Okay, these are my two options. I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
But we've done it together. Mm-hmm. And that is the only thing that will bring you as a playing group strong and will keep you strong. If you do stuff together, you're going to stay together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's doing the stuff where you play the story, where you play D&D, but it's also doing the stuff where you help each other with problems, and it's also doing the stuff that are not D&D related. My players are my friends,
mm-hmm.
even if I didn't know them before, and now they are my friends, because we also play other games together,
mm-hmm.
because we do LAN parties together, because we game together, because we do drinking games together, we do a lot of things together.
Mm-hmm. Yep, with three of my players, well, we did when we could do it. We had board game night every other week. The week that D&D was off. Now, ultimately, that board game is a dungeon crawler, so yeah, I'll leave it to the audience to decide how different that is an experience. But it was different enough for my perspective. But yeah, I get it. It is meeting halfway. I'm not, you know, this isn't me putting down an iron fist, or at least it's not what I intended it to be. It was probably just a less eloquent way of saying, here's my structure and here's what I need to be happy. Now I can ask them, you know, what do you need to do that? I fear that their answer will be nothing, because I don't want to do it. So I'm maybe presuming too much, but at least for one or two of them, that's what I imagine it might end up being, which of course then the outcome is predetermined to a certain extent, which is what I've tried to foreshadow in real life. Weirdly, I'm better at foreshadowing in real life than I am in the game of what might happen.
Yeah, that's because of the responsibility that you have. When you work in a way that you try to make the game empowering for mm-hmm. everyone in it, then people get a responsibility for that game. And that's what I mean when we're together with our players.
Mm.
We are both responsible for the fun we have at the table.
Yeah.
We are both responsible for the structure, and we are both responsible to take care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling your players, I need you to take care of me. And if they don't, then that's their responsibility, and that act is going to have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Yeah, for sure. It's one of those, you know, as you said earlier on, to be cruel, to be kind kind of thing. Wow. I mean, from starting with such a benign word like structure, I really didn't think I'd be having this heart-to-heart at the end of it, but I'm very glad that is where the discussion has taken us. Do you have anything in particular you wanted to cover around the topic of structure that we haven't covered already?
We haven't really talked about the structure of the rules of the D&D 5e system, but
mm-hmm.
to me that's not as important, because it's the same as everything I've said before. You create the structure you need, and then you go from there on. So your rules are there to set the structure, but you can use them in the way you want and that feels naturally to you. Some mm-hmm. people need set DCs beforehand. I personally don't. I don't like to play with set DCs beforehand, because if I'm running a written game and I see, okay, it's a DC 25 or it's a DC 12 or whatever, I know I'm going to change it in my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Depending on the situation with the players. So, but some people need that.
Yeah, and that's just the nature of the DMing styles we were talking about earlier on, about short form pre-generated adventures versus homebrew sandbox is probably the two kind of extremes. I think that the rules as a structure do about as good as a job as it can of hitting that middle ground of enabling collaborative storytelling, but also facilitating RPG leveling and, you know, XP and dice rolling. I think, yeah, it's, you know, there are some shortcomings, but to have a game of that vastness and that breadth, there are of course going to be shortcomings.
I can maybe end with a little tip for new DMs or DMs who are figuring out how much structure do I need to run my game, I would say run a couple of one-shots where you go into everything written out in detail from nothing written and you just roll with random tables and then you'll easily figure out how much structure you need and what the benefits are of a larger structure, the benefits are of a smaller structure, and how this can benefit or influence your players.
And by doing that, you'll also get an idea of how quickly players progress through the structure, which is something that I found can rubber band. You know, players can take a lot longer to get through stuff, and even now I'm still like, okay, I'm actually prepared now for the next 6 months because of the velocity of players through a structure. So yeah, that's a really good tip, really good advice, just getting that experience of DMing and where you find your own comfort zone of, okay, yeah, I can blag that on the fly and it makes sense and my players won't notice, versus, okay, no, this needs to be here because somebody better than me told me it should be a DC 15 and that makes sense.
Yeah, just don't be afraid to experiment with it.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I personally take a lot of artistic license when it comes to making decisions on the fly, and I'm exactly the same school of thought of yours of making that DC up on the fly, if only for the fact of when somebody sets a DC, that's set in stone, you know, it's frozen in time under those specific circumstances. But maybe when you come to run it, the players are town heroes for some reason. So maybe the DC should actually be lower because the town love these guys. Whereas if you're running it blow for blow, that DC might be unusually high. If all the players are trying to do is, you know, get a discount on something, you might want to get rid of the DC completely in that instance. But it's because it's the nature of the game that it can change going through is what keeps me coming back.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep some parts of the game fluid.
Yes, for sure.
And how fluent you want your game to be depends on DM to DM.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Cool. All right. That brings us pretty much to the end. And that was been, quite an introspection of me as a DM, which is nice to have, you know, to have that sounding board to that level to, you know, see where, and I'm always looking where to improve. So I personally, thank you very much. But I'm hoping that through the discussion we've had, there's no hope about it. I know through the discussion we've had, there's been so many little nuggets of advice and tips and, you know, just food for thought for both players and DMs. And the fact that that's come from a springboard of the word structure is just fantastic. And I couldn't be happier. So thank you ever so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Is there anything you would like to plug?
Oh, okay. So right now we have an adventure on the DM's Guild. It's called The Nine of Heimdall. It's the kind of adventure I talked about in the beginning, kind of the spiderweb sandbox structure. Mm-hmm. It's an 8 to 12 hour story, but you can change it in a way you want as a DM. There's also in the beginning of the adventure, there's a part about empowering the Game Master, in which I tell you how you can change up the different acts of the story to put out a heavier spot on the pillar of adventure you like, so combat, roleplay, or investigation. Mm. Yeah, go have a look. It's on DM's Guild right now.
Mm. I'm going to have to check that out and possibly steal that thing at the front, because one thing I've been struggling with when writing mine is to try and explain that stance of DM, just do what you feel is right throughout. So that sounds like very good advice. To everybody at home, thank you all for listening. If you've got any thoughts or comments on today's topic, feel free to drop me a tweet at Danlo_DND. Otherwise, thank you and good night.